Two little fishes, five loaves of bread. And as a result, Jesus fed 5,000 men, plus more women and children whose numbers are not recorded for us. This story of the feeding of the 5,000 appears in all four gospel accounts of Jesus' life. And actually, there are probably not as many stories about Jesus that appear in all four gospels as you think. I think actually there are only two, and there's no prizes if you can recall the other one. Not even the Last Supper, the origin of the communion we are going to celebrate today, is in all four Gospels. That meal in the upper room is not mentioned in the Gospel of John, where I took a reading from this morning, for the feeding of the 5,000. So does that mean that John didn't think that the memorial act of communion was important? Well, no, we can't say that. John was probably the last of the four Gospels to be written, once the church was probably quite well underway, and after many practices such as the taking of communion would have already become recognized markers of the Christian church. Communion has been, since the very earliest days of the church, an important marker of the church, something by which you would know that a gathering was a gathering of professing Christians rather than some other sect or some other gathering of people. We in Scotland, indeed in the wider Reformed Church, like order. We like rationality. We like things to be explained to us clearly and unambiguously. So how, wanting order and unambiguous explanations, can we get past the fact that John doesn't relate to us the central act of taking part in the communion meal in his gospel story? Well, the answer is here, in the feeding of the 5,000 men and others. In all the Gospels, this feeding is used as a pointer towards the later meal in Jerusalem, taken the night before Jesus died. But in the other three, arguably something of the emphasis of communion is placed on communion as a memorial act, to help us remember what it was and is that Christ did at Calvary, in dying on the cross, rising from his tomb, and ascending back to heaven to the Father's side. John's emphasis is slightly different to communion as a memorial. Now, it's not that John does not attach supreme importance to the knowledge that Christ was God, who died and rose and ascended to cure us of the effects of our sins. However, what I want to do is to consider something of the feeding of the 5,000 men in John, to show that John's emphasizing in what John is emphasizing in the act of communion. The purpose of John's gospel is to show that Jesus is God in human form. So the signs in John's version of the feeding of the 5,000 are designed to show God at work in the lives of God's people. And this miracle took place shortly after Jesus learned that his cousin, John the Baptist, had been executed by King Herod. Notwithstanding an almost unique ability for Jesus to view the long game, nevertheless, it must be very likely that Jesus was filled with grief and a sense of loneliness as he prayed to God. John the Baptist's faithfulness and his courage had cost him his life. And it's quite likely that Jesus wondered about his own approaching death, something necessary but not viewed with relish even by God. The feeding of the 5,000 is John's version of the Last Supper. And just like the Last Supper and Jesus' death, the feeding of the 5,000 gives us hope for the future. The feeding of the 5,000 was a sign of that later eating and drinking that would be God's saving provision for our salvation. Like feeding the 5,000, Holy Communion is a community meal. It's not something we do alone. Our online community do it with us here, with those who are here gathered in the building of Palmerston Place, because in person and online, we are one community, one body. Communion is not just about our personal salvation, an act of each individual coming forward to take the elements. Rather, communion is the act of a group of people, We are saved and fed as a community. And as a community, we are called to feed others. And that's why, when we come to take communion later, I'll ask you to hold on to the elements of bread and wine when you collect them and take them back to your seat, so that we can then enjoy them all at the same time together, rather than as a succession of individual acts taken in our own time. Perhaps ideally, we should all sit around a big table and take communion as part of a meal, but that is not our tradition in this church. Perhaps it should be. Anyway, the feeding of the 5,000 men and others, like the parable of the mustard seed, which I've referred to in passing a couple of times in the last month, are both examples of the old saying that big things can come in small packages. What seems like such a little amount became so much. God uses ordinary people to do extraordinary things, including the boy and his rather meager lunch. Little is much when God is in it. And little is much when we place it into God's hands. The feeding of the 5,000 is recorded by John in his Gospel as a demonstration of God's grace. God doing in and through us those things that we cannot do through our own efforts. God moves mountains when we have faith the size of the grain of a mustard seed. God feeds more than 5,000 people when one boy gives Jesus all that he had. Jesus used the feeding of the 5,000 men and others as an opportunity to teach the disciples, and therefore to teach us as well. Jesus saw an opportunity to let the disciples fail, but through that, Jesus would teach them a lesson. And in teaching them, Jesus strengthens them and also strengthens us. Now, we're told the reactions of two of the disciples to Jesus' instruction to feed the crowd. Philip saw the need for a miracle, and he calculated the odds rationally. How many people are there? How much would each need to eat? What would it cost to buy that much food? He tried to prove that it could not be done. We just don't have the money. It's perhaps something that we can sympathize with as the cost of living rises and we're struck with drastic cost-cutting exercises within the Church of Scotland as we try to refocus on mission and telling those who have not heard about all that Christ offers to us. How many times are we like Philip? How often do we fail to see what God is doing because we're focused on our own worries, our desires, and our needs, our fears of not having enough or of not being enough? Philip looked at the problem in terms of meeting the minimum requirements. If a little for each person was impossible, the abundance was not even worth considering. Pessimists think like that. Don't be a pessimist. Good things and exciting things are happening now, but I know they can be unsettling. Settling for it's I been this way, or what we know has I been possible, is not good enough. We have the chance to grow God's kingdom here and now, just like Jesus did, and we should seize what we have and use it. Now, I'm not saying that I condemn pessimists at all. Indeed, I'm not saying that I'm not pessimistic myself sometimes. I'm not saying that I've already got this and I'm the example that you must follow. I need to work on it as well. Now, Andrew, on the other hand, he set out to try to solve the problem and find the solution. He found the key to the first part of this story. He considered the possibility that the people might provide for themselves with a little leadership. He searched for food among the people, but he found only one boy with a small lunch that had seemed totally inadequate to the task at hand. Now, we should give credit to Andrew for at least trying to find a solution to the problem. Let's look at the boy's lunch for a moment. Now, when I was in Sunday school, I used to think that 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish was actually quite a lot. Granted, it wasn't enough to feed over 5,000 people, but it was a big meal nonetheless, certainly enough to feed my whole family, grandparents included. But the loaves were not mother's pride. Rather, they would be small, flat, unleavened pieces of bread, probably smaller than the pita bread you could buy in the supermarket now. These are barley loaves, and barley was a major part of the diet of the poor. And the fish were not grand salmon or cod or haddock, but probably would be small fish, something like the size of a sardine. The meal was actually, in fact, barely enough for one boy, let alone enough to satisfy the appetite of a grown man, and certainly nowhere near enough to feed a family, as I thought. And obviously, it certainly was not enough to feed over 5,000 people. When Jesus accepted the boy's gift, Jesus looked to heaven and blessed it. Through Jesus' blessing, the small lunch became a great quantity. There was suddenly enough bread because Jesus saw the people and Jesus wanted them to be fed. He loved the crowd and he gave that hungry crowd peace through his presence and through his actions. What we don't see, as is sometimes argued, is that one boy in sharing guilt-tripped the rest of the 5,000 plus people to share the food that they were secretly hoarding for themselves. Doing that would not be a miracle. It would be a moral lesson, but Jesus is not that kind of God. Jesus does not operate to enable us to achieve the possible. Jesus is God, and through his actions, the impossible is what happens. In that, 5 loaves and 2 fish and no more, that 5 loaves and those 2 fish really do feed 5,000 men and more women and children like the boy besides. The boy wasn't just armed with the food Jesus needed to feed the others. The boy also must have had a humble heart and a generous spirit because he gave up his small lunch. The boy was best positioned to give because someone had already empowered him to do so. Perhaps his mother or an aunt, grandmother, or some other guardian had not only given him a packed lunch, but the boy had also been taught some generosity of spirit, not to hoard things for himself, but to willingly share his small lunch. And in the end, it resulted in many, many benefiting from his small lunch through the love and grace of Jesus. Jesus intended for his miracle to point people to God, and that included his disciples and everyone he met. The people realized that the food they had eaten was a sign from God, and that they might believe in Jesus, and they did. They realized that he was the long-promised Messiah, but he wasn't the type of Messiah for which they were looking. They came to Jesus and followed him, hoping for some kind of spectacle, the spectacle of fireworks shows and miracles, if you like. They, the crowds, did not follow because of who Jesus was. Perhaps they were enthralled listening to his teaching, and perhaps even more so, they were enthralled about the possibility of what he might do for them. Jesus told the disciples to collect the leftovers in large wicker baskets, the kind old fishwives would use, not the small baskets you might serve bread in at a dining table. You see, nothing is impossible with God. However, we don't remember that, do we? Or perhaps we don't really believe that nothing is impossible with God. We often think in terms of what we have to offer and what we can accomplish through human means, and I'm no different. I look at what I have to do each week and I think, how will I manage all that? And the answer is, I won't. But with God, I will. The answer is to turn our resources over to God and to let him go to work. As long as we think we have to come up with a solution, we will be anxious, stressed, irritable, and frantic. Once we realize that we aren't adequate for the task, that Jesus will have to step in, and we turn to him, then we have peace as we wait for his plan to unfold. When Jesus sets before us a task that seems to be impossible, he knows what he is going to do. He watches us and perhaps tests us to see how we will react in fear, confusion, or in faith. Jesus offers us enough resources to do his work in our world, but we must receive them from him in order to give them to other people. God starts with what we have. And we can give God everything in our lives, our hearts, our reputations, our pasts, our presents, and our future. The point is clear. Jesus always brings his power to the rescue of human inadequacy. He turned an impossible situation into an opportunity to teach and strengthen the confidence of his believers, and he still does that now. Can we trust Jesus even when the circumstances seem impossible? Will we give to him all we have so that he can do big things in our lives? When we show that we're willing to trust him and not hold back, he will do great things in our lives. Let's bring it back to the Presbytery of Edinburgh and West Lothian. How can we apply this to the upheaval happening within the Church of Scotland? I think Philip and Andrew show us the difference between two types of churches, missional ones and maintenance ones. Missional churches welcome all situations and see the potential while acknowledging that there are challenges and that these situations create. Maintenance churches focus more on creating committees that make decisions and not disciples. Maintenance churches distance themselves from problems because they're too busy having committee meetings. Maintenance churches are often also filled with tension because the members don't know what's going to happen or how to respond. They do just enough to get by. Missional churches look for things to do, even when their members are already doing things. They believe that because God is in what they are doing, God will provide everything that they will need. Maintenance churches are paralyzed by the size and scope of the task before them, but missional churches break the task down into manageable parts. They don't try to do everything all at once because they know that they can't be everything to everyone all the time. Jesus accepts their limitations and only expects them to work with what they have, with what they are given, and with the next people that they meet. Which type of church would you prefer to be? During this gap time between Colin retiring and Palmerston Place being permitted to call a new parish minister, don't lose the heart of what this church has always been. It is a missional congregation. You seeking out where God is leading and then biting off chunks of that task, bit by bit, until we have reached the point to which God is leading us. Take a chance when it's presented to you by God. Don't shy away, but step out, holding God's hand in our hand. Today is a day when we come together to celebrate communion, both here in the church and hopefully with those of our congregation logging in online, albeit I can't see them. The other thing we see is that we see the disciples doing what they're doing is working together as Jesus tells them. They're distributing food, collecting leftovers, being the community that Christ is building them to be. And that's what we need to be here, in person as well as online. Whether you're watching live or later on, we are all one church, one community. And that unity is also shown in our taking communion together as a community, not as a group of individuals. We're saved as a church, not as a single soul. Let us celebrate our unity in Christ in our communion and also as we prepare in singing our next item of praise, which is perhaps the most traditional praise of the Church of Scotland and a constant as I was growing up in the Highlands at every communion service. Remember that the tune changes partway through, but you'll know when that happens. Let us join together and sing Psalm 24, "The earth belongs to God alone."